Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts. Hey, it's Francis. You know, the last thing I expected to hear when we made this spring baking episode last year was for a star pastry chef to tell us how good overbaked cake can be. That is just one surprise of many. Check it out. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. You know, it is technically spring now, but for a lot of the country, look, this winter has just felt absolutely endless. It snowed in L.A. Did you hear that? It snowed in L.A. The Twin Cities got like 7 feet of it. And meanwhile, here in New York, it's been such a weirdly mild winter, but it has just been unrelentingly gray for 4 months. Anyway, what I'm saying is, if winter is going to insist on sticking around, we might as well make the most of it and get cozy with the oven on and something delicious baking inside of it. So this week, we are talking with three fabulous, totally different baking experts. We have Chetna McCann, who won millions of hearts on the Great British Baking Show, talking about her Indian-inspired easy bakes. Esteban Castillo, the man behind the beloved blog Chicano Eats, will come talk about his love of Mexican sweetbreads and cakes. And first, we have one of the great gems of New York City, the pastry chef Natasha Pickowitz. Natasha was for years the leader of the sweets team at some of New York's coolest restaurants, Altro Paradiso and Flora Bar, where she made a reputation even among fellow pastry chefs for marrying simplicity with unique flavors and a lot of shopping at the farmer's market. Well, her new book is written for home bakers. It's called More Than Cake, 100 Baking Recipes for Pleasure and Community. Hey, chef, it's great to have you on the show.
Hi, I'm so happy to be here.
I love your enormously filled bookshelves behind you. Like, you truly have more books than I do.
This is actually not even the cookbook portion of my collection, which I keep like closer to my kitchen area. But I love all my books.
So congratulations on having your own to put on that pile. It's awesome. I want to eat you. Every single page. And, you know, one thing I think was so interesting about your book as I was reading it is, you know, you have all these recipes that have these really unique flavor combinations that I think would probably be exciting and thrilling to see in a restaurant. But you really wrote this with a home baker in mind, it seems to me. And I want to actually first ask you about your recipe testing process, because when you were testing it, you were kind of like intentionally trying to screw them up almost, right? You were trying to be like, if I don't have this, can I still make it? You know, like, tell me about that whole process.
Yeah. I mean, recipe testing is such an exhaustive, thorough, kind of meticulous process. And I really wanted to understand how the recipes worked through failures and through mistakes, because I actually feel like failures are this incredible opportunity to sort of understand the nuances of a technique or an ingredient or, you know, a genre of baking. Not that I was like intentionally trying to mess anything up, but I really wanted to see how things would react the more I kind of played and messed around with certain things. And, you know, that's everything from, you know, taking a recipe and scaling it up, scaling it down. How is something going to respond when you change batch size? How is something going to respond when you mess around with the temperature of ingredients, temperature of your oven, you know, and what the ingredients are? And I really was curious. And sometimes there are little breakthroughs or revelations that come from that process, you know, and I think a lot of chefs identify with that part of it too, is sort of these discoveries that, you know, they don't feel arbitrary, but they feel like you kind of stumbled upon something magical. And I think that comes through this sort of process of trial and error, because I really wanted to respect the reader and the home baker and imagine the kind of situation they might find themselves in if, you know, they forgot to temper their butter, or if they don't have any, you know, bleached flour, but they have a whole grain flour. Like, how will that affect the recipe? Because mm-hmm. I know, like, that somebody's home kitchen isn't going to really look exactly like mine or exactly like yours.
Sure.
So I wanted to create recipes that I thought, you know, people could play around with and hopefully make their own.
Yeah. Were there any recipes that really surprised you when you were testing this way? Like, oh, wow, I didn't realize that would actually work, or?
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, I have a recipe in the book, and I don't use the word biscotti in describing what the recipe is. And they're called, it's the fennel seed and chocolate hazelnut spears. Mm-hmm. And that was actually a really funny one, because I had made biscotti for years and years at the Italian restaurant Altro Paradiso. And I was working on a recipe for the book, and in the process of scaling it down from my giant restaurant batch size mm-hmm. to the home kitchen batch size, I messed up the quantities of the butter and the sugar, and okay. I didn't, you know, do the math properly. And there was so much butter and sugar in the cookie, they kind of spread like lava on the sheet pan in this way where I was like, oh my God, what did I do? It looks insane. And then I let it cool and I took a little nibble and I was like, oh my gosh, this is the most delicious thing. And it actually, you know, butter is not a traditional ingredient in biscotti. You know, usually okay, you're not yeah. going to see butter at all, but I really loved how it made this kind of melt in your mouth texture with this kind of crisp buttery cookie. So I kind of stayed with it. And I was like, this is a kind of a decadent twist on, you know, the kind of molar crunching cookie mm-hmm. that we know is biscotti. I wanted something a little more supple, a little bit more like sexy and decadent. And I was really happy with how it came out, which was, you know, kind of a mess up originally, but I was determined not to throw anything away. And I just wanted to see where it would go.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, actually, let's talk about yeah. that too, because I know that's a hallmark of yours. You're like, look, if you overbake something, I'm going to find something to do with it. What are some of your
yeah.
best saves after something does get messed up? Like, what are some things you've made out of something that didn't turn out?
I mean, I hate throwing things away. I like don't really, and like I said, I feel like mistakes are so important for, you know, how we learn and become more comfortable with ourselves as home bakers. But I'm always determined to just like find a way out of something, even if it seems like it's a mistake. And often I find like, you know, when I had home bakers, like truly amateur, not industry people testing recipes from my book, mm-hmm. and they would be like, I don't think it's like working out right. And they would send me photos and I would be like, you're on the right path. I think this is great, you know? And so I think like adding that reassurance is really helpful for the home baker too. But, you know, yeah, I think the overbaked cake is an incredible example, because my whole philosophy towards cake baking, or especially layer cake making, is that we're adding layers of flavor through things like, you know, creamy fillings and flavorful soaks. So I love baking these real thin kind of absorbent, spongy cake layers that sort of can handle, you know, a wash of, you know, bitter coffee or kind of like a, you know, a boozy tequila soak or a fatty mm-hmm. coconut milk. So if you overbake something in the oven, like a sheet cake, and it feels brittle or crisp or fragile or dry, I'm like, don't throw it away. Like, let's soak it with something delicious, and it'll rehydrate in that process and it'll be delicious. You know, like there's so many desserts that kind of riff off of that idea, but I wanted to reassure the reader that if you thought you were making a mistake, there's still a way to kind of go back and save it.
Yeah. Actually, I worked on an ice cream book many years ago. This really, really amazing author and chef named Dana Cree. And the very last recipe in the book.
I have that book.
It's awesome.
One
Thank
of the
you
best.
For buying it.
Yeah.
And it's like very nerdy. You know, it's just like a deep, deep dive into like how ice creams work. And I love that the last recipe in the book is, okay, if you really did mess up an ice cream base, here's how you turn it into a cake. And I don't mean an ice cream cake, like literally like add flour, add eggs, and like it'll actually bake up into an amazing cake. I'm like, oh my God, like that's so smart.
Incredible.
Yeah.
It's true. I think like that's exactly the kind of critical thinking that I'm really hoping readers will take to heart. And I think pastry specifically is this area where people are like, must follow recipe step by step. If I don't, I will fail. And I think once you sort of engage that critical thinking part of your brain, where you're like, okay, if I've overbeaten this whipped cream and it looks grainy, I know I can stream in a little liquid cream and it'll become silky and look smooth again. So I think this is the kind of like brain rewiring, arranging that feels so good to have once you have this sort of map of the book in front of you, and then you kind of start to solve your own problems. And I just love that feeling. It's so empowering, and it feels incredible to sort of have that, you know, confidence with ingredients and technique.
Yeah. Wait, you could actually save over whipped whipped cream?
You could save anything. You could save over whipped egg whites. Like, this was something that also happened to me a lot in recipe testing, where like I would have a million things going at the same time. So I'm like, stuff in the oven, there's like nuts toasting in a pan, there's like a stand mixer on high beating egg whites. And everyone knows, you turn your back for a second, it goes from like perfectly glossy meringue to over whipped disaster. And I had this like large batch of meringue going, and I'm like, no, I cannot start this over. Like, I'm timing it with the syrup I'm cooking at the same time for a buttercream.
Yeah.
So I just slipped another raw egg white into it, and it smoothed it right out.
That's wild.
And whipped cream is the same way. It can, you know, you whip cream too long and it becomes butter.
Yeah.
But there's a phase where it looks gritty or grainy and it kind of doesn't look that yummy. If you stream in just liquid cream, it'll bring it back to life and give you that texture you want. Yeah.
That's wild. That's awesome. That's Natasha Pickowitz, author of More Than Cake. We'll be back in a minute to talk about her recipes, including one for granola shortbread. And then...
You know, our culture is already so colorful. You see color everywhere. And so I think just embedding color into our pastries is just an extension of the culture. For me, color has always been a really big part of my life and the work that I do. I love bright colors. It's the way that I get to also infuse my queer identity into my work. You know, these colors are really loud. They're very vibrant and saturated. It's just such a huge part of my life.
That's Esteban Castillo, author of Chicano Bakes. We'll be back in a minute. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Our show is supported by Hero Bread. You know, for a lot of us, bread has been a staple all our lives. Toast at breakfast, sandwiches at lunch, a nice buttered roll at dinner. It's comforting and delicious, and bread is often what we crave. But sometimes it can sit a little heavy after a meal. That's where Hero Bread comes in. They've created fluffy, delicious versions of the breads that we're used to, but that include no net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and fewer calories. Oh, and there's more good stuff too, like protein and fiber. Hero Bread has everything from your daily sandwich loaf to tortillas or hot dog and hamburger buns. The products are flavorful, and they have something for every craving, from a dressed-up breakfast burrito to a late-night PB&J. They even have monthly small batch drops of indulgent treats like 2 gram net carb Hero croissant or the 1 gram net carb Hero cheddar biscuit. Don't give up being a breadhead. Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code TABLE at checkout. That's TABLE at hero.co. Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its 4th season. In every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking an amazing meal. Listen as Ina does what she does best, make good conversation and delicious food, while making it sound fun and easy. This season, Ina dives into conversation with astronaut and colonel Nicole Mann. As Ina teaches Nicole how to make seared scallops with celery root puree, they talk about everything from family to what foods Nicole really craves when she's in space. And listen in as Ina and Pulitzer Prize-winning writer David Remnick talk about music lessons and the value of developing language skills before joining their spouses for a lively conversation over a comforting dish of chicken parmesan. If you love a good chat over a great meal, you'll love Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're all about baking today, from New York to Mexico to London by way of India. And right now, we're talking to Natasha Pickowitz, author of the new book, More Than Cake. And we're getting into some of the really good stuff in those pages. Let's get back to it. So I want to talk to you about a couple of recipes in the book. One of them is the granola shortbread. I mean, shortbread is delicious and classic. You know, we all love it. Basically, it's butter, flour, sugar. But in this shortbread dough, you just straight up like grab some granola that you like and add it to it. Like that makes up a big part of the dough itself, which I've never seen before. And the other is that instead of like all-purpose flour, you use rice flour. So tell us about both of those things and what comes out in the end.
Yeah. Well, I love that you pointed that recipe out. Shortbread is one of my favorite things in the world. I love the texture. I love like a bar. And I love this recipe. It's actually had its origins when we opened Flora Bar and Coffee at the Met Broyer back in 2016. And at the time, I was developing like a full menu of pastries for the coffee bar that was like, you know, servicing museum guests. And first of all, I wanted to have a gluten-free pastry, and I had a bunch of like Vietnamese white rice flour that I was testing with like a streusel with other stuff, and I had it laying around. And I found that when you're making a buttery cookie, that mouthfeel of kind of almost like a sandy short texture that you get with rice flour is like super delicious and kind of a shortbread treatment.
Oh, cool.
So that was kind of a happy coincidence of like, checks the box for being gluten-free, but also makes the pastry better than what it would have been if I'd used wheat flour.
Super cool.
And the granola was, at the time, we had this like granola parfait in the cafe where we were like, you know, selling little like yogurt bowls with fruit and granola. And we would have little bits of granola left over that we didn't use for the parfait. And I was like, what can I use this for? Like, it's so delicious. Like,
queen
it's
of not throwing away.
I know. I'm obsessed. And I was like, what can I use this for? So I ground it kind of into a coarse crumb, kind of like a bread crummy texture, and threw it in with the shortbread. And it added so much surprising depth of flavor and, you know, kind of like a nuttiness, sort of, it just added like great body to this cookie and made it feel really unexpected. And it was a great way for us to use these scraps that we didn't have. So I was like, okay, this is the perfect thing to have in the book, because who doesn't have like four jars of granola that are like half empty at any given moment, like a baggie of this or whatever of that, like I always do. And so I tested the recipe with a million different kinds of granola, vegan granola, buttery granola, you know, nuts, whatever. I mean, as long as it doesn't have like, you know, big chocolate chunks in it that might like, you really can use whatever you want. And I loved this idea of like, you know, a reader might have a granola that they love at home. And so when they make that shortbread, it won't taste like the one that I made with my granola, but, you know, it becomes theirs.
Yeah. Another recipe is the crunchy almond cake. Now, I am a absolute almond lover. Like, I used to be like, oh, chocolate, everything, always chocolate for dessert. At some point, like, the switch flipped. And I'm like, if there's almond flavor anything, that's what I'm getting.
Yes.
But I have to say, I looked at the recipe, and you first say you make your own marzipan for it. So then I'm like, I'm out.
But like, Francis, honestly, it couldn't be easier. It's literally like almond flour or meal, sugar, and an egg white. I mean, when I started recipe testing, like the easiest version to make, I was like, oh, wow, this is actually so much more simple than I thought. But it's all about the texture is so much improved. It's like, you know, Play-Doh versus like pebbles outside. Like it's like a supple, moldable, squishy, tender, like so yummy. And it's from the egg white. And it's not like that kind of shellacked, ornamental, kind of tough marzipan you might see in like, you know, sitting out in a bakery counter, like for who knows how long. Like this is a different, a whole other thing. So I really wanted to be like, hey, you know, if you have egg whites like sitting around, like you can make marzipan, it'll stay good forever, keep it in your freezer. And now you get this like yummy kind of rope of marzipan running through the core of the cake, which is like the best surprise.
Oh man. Okay. So just to finish with that recipe, you make that marzipan, you roll it out into a rope, and then you like basically pour cake batter around it in a loaf pan, right? You bake it so then you have this beautiful loaf cake with this core of this chewy, sticky, yummy marzipan in the middle, and then you have like a crunchy almond topping on top.
Yes. Oh my God. Even just, I'm like, even you describing my recipe, I'm like, that sounds good. I'd like some of that right now.
Who thought of that?
It is one of my favorite recipes in the book and one of my favorite photographs too. But the topping might be one of my favorite parts actually. And it was inspired by this cake I made at this restaurant I worked in Montreal called Lawrence, called a Queen Elizabeth cake, where you have a sheet cake and you broil this kind of toffee-like kind of coconut sticky topping on top of it until it gets kind of crispy and golden. And so I wanted to try that, but with sliced almonds, which are one of my favorite ingredients just to play around with. And I loved how the nuts got kind of crispy and sticky and crunchy in the under the broiler. And then you get this kind of like no frosting needed. You get this kind of crunchy halo of like almonds on top of the cake. And I just, it's so good. Mm. You just have to sort of, you know, with the broiler, babysit a little bit, make sure the nuts don't burn.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, again, what's the worst that happens? The nuts burn, scrape the topping off and like do it again. You know, it's like, doesn't mean the cake is ruined. It just might mean that you're picking out a few kind of dark slivers slices, of almond. Yeah.
Right on. And then very sliceable and packable, and you can put it on a table for a bake sale. So I know you are very passionate about bake sales. Tell us about them. Why are you so into like this thing that my kids' school asked me to participate in once every single month?
I love that.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's like I get more notices about the bake sales at the school than like, you know, when the report card's coming out.
Right. Well, they might be onto something because it is a surprisingly effective way of like bringing communities, groups of people together. And I think for me, you know, when I'm thinking about ways that I want to show up for my community, participate in my neighborhood, connect with other people, often that's a practice of, you know, looking inward and being like, what is my skill set? What can I contribute? What do I know how to do? And the first bake sale that I produced was in 2017. You know, so I was working in restaurants full time then. And I really loved this sort of idea, this sort of tension of asking a fine dining pastry chef to sort of make something that we could sell for $5 or $10. And I love this idea of creating an inclusive, accessible event for anybody to come to if they want and be able to kind of taste and meet the pastry chef of restaurants that they might not even be able to afford to go to. Like, you know, maybe you can't eat at Le Bernardin, but you can meet their pastry chef and try a treat of theirs for like $5 or $10. Like I thought that was just such a great way of sort of bringing the pastry chef community in New York City together and really opening it up to the community and being like, anybody can come check it out. And of course, like the camaraderie, the incredible camaraderie and support of the restaurant community with pastry chefs and bakers specifically was something that is like really moved me. You know, the way that people are just so like, absolutely, what do you need? Where can I be? Like, it makes me feel emotional, you know? This was just, the bake sales really, you know, it resonated with me. And I think it with a lot of other people here in New York too. So it's really something that I've continued to do, you know, since then. And, you know, I'm producing two huge bake sales for the launch of the book, which, you know, is a dream come true because, you know, obviously I was so excited to celebrate the book. Mm-hmm. So we were like partnering up with Kitchen Arts and Letters here in New York City. We're partnering up with Now Serving in LA.
Yeah, great bookstore, and,
Yeah, like incredible, passionate, smart, curious people who are just like, what can we do? Let's do this thing. And it's been a joy to collaborate with booksellers for bake sales for the first time.
Yeah. And where are the proceeds going?
In New York, this is the first time I've been able to share this, which is so exciting, but we're partnering up with the nonprofit that is created and based in New York City called the Bridget Alliance. And they sort of provide resources and funds for people who are seeking like abortion services and care like outside of their home state. Mm-hmm. So a nonprofit like that will actually connect the dots for a person out of state to a larger organization like Planned Parenthood, for example, mm-hmm. which is the other nonprofit that I've worked with for my bake sales. So I really love that through line of kind of keeping it local, working with people, you know, that are living and eating in our communities, and sort of, you know, they're a huge part of the bake sale. They'll have a big table. They're going to have their own, like, you know, offerings. And mm-hmm, it's mm-hmm. It's incredible to have them in the mix and, you know, continue to like bring awareness to the, you know, super important work that they do.
That's awesome. Well, thank you, Chef. This has been so great to talk with you. And I really want to come to your bake sale.
I hope to see you there. Thank you so much for having me.
Natasha Pickowitz is the author of More Than Cake, 100 Baking Recipes Built for Pleasure and Community. And she left us with a recipe for one of her, well, she called it a mistake, but it sounds incredible, fennel, chocolate, and hazelnut spears. Find it at splendidtable.org. Esteban Castillo is one of those maddeningly talented triple threat types. He's the writer, recipe developer, and photographer behind his beloved blog and cookbook, Chicano Eats, and his new book, Chicano Bakes, which is all about the breads and pastries of Mexico. So from the multicolored buns to the jiggly gelatinas to the super soaked tres leches cakes, Mexican bakeries are among my favorite places to be in the world. And Esteban is here to tell us about his take on them. Hey, Esteban, it's great to see you.
Hi, Francis.
You know, the corn tortilla is obviously the staple food of so much of Mexico. And I think that's maybe the first thing a lot of people think of. You know, we think of corn. We don't necessarily think of wheat flour. But there's such a rich bread and pastry culture. Tell us what that Mexican baking culture like has meant to you.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting because I feel like when people think about Mexican food, they don't necessarily think about the sweet side of our culture. Mm-hmm. It plays such a huge part in so many different festivities and holidays and just our day-to-day that it's often overlooked. But I grew up in Southern California in Santana, and I grew up right behind El Toro Meat Market. For those of you listening, if you live near Santana, take a trip down there. So there's El Toro Meat Market. They have a little deli section. And then right next door is a panaderia. So we had access to fresh pan dulce every single day. We would just walk across the street. And, you know, we could always tell when the panadero was taking out fresh loaves and buns because you could smell it in the air. I miss living in
behind
that sort of...
Yeah, a bakery.
Behind a bakery.
Okay, so what were some of your favorite things? Or like, not just there, but if you're walking into a panaderia, and I love that word, it's literally like bread store, right? Like if you're walking into a panaderia, what are the things that we should look for?
Yeah, I mean, the panaderia experience here in the U.S. is completely different than what you're going to find in Mexico. In Mexico, they might specialize in certain different breads, but you aren't going to be able to walk into a panaderia and order a cake. You know, there's going to be someone else who's going to specialize in cakes. But here in the U.S., you walk into a panaderia and they're going to offer you everything. Depending on where you live, you are going to be able to order cakes or jellos or flans or pan dulce or even savory things. It really just depends on who the panadero is, what they're doing with the things that they're making. But you can always count on a couple of different things, and that's going to be the conchas. It's these sweet buns with a sugar streusel on top in the shape of a shell, which is how they get their name.
Concha means shell, right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You're also going to find mantecadas, which are these sweet buttery muffins, and everybody always has them in like a red liner. You are also going to find rebanadas, which are slices of bread with butter on top and then sprinkled with sugar. You're also going to find teleras and bolillos, which are typically used for savory things like tortas.
Sandwich bowls. Oh God, they're so good.
polvorones, which are sort of like Mexico's sugar cookie. And sometimes when I say polvorones, people tend to get a little confused because we actually have like There's like four or five different cookies that share the same name.
if you know, you know.
Yeah. And we also repurpose stuff. The dough for polvoron can be used to make so many different other cookies. And so it's these little core group of things that you're going to be able to find at any panaderia here in the U.S.
Okay, that's good to know. You've mentioned pan dulce. So, I mean, just translating, that means sweet bread, right? So
yeah.
That's, and that's different from pastries and danishes, and it's different from cakes. It's literally sweetened breads, and there's a whole tradition of them. You mentioned the conchas and the muffins. One thing I have noticed and I'm curious about is a lot of times there seems to be a very, like, it's an important emphasis on the color mm-hmm. of these items. You mentioned the muffins come in a red liner, and conchas with that sugar, that sort of a crusty, streusely topping, that sugary topping is often colored, right? Sometimes I see it blue, sometimes I see it pink. Tell us about that tradition of that color. Why is that important?
I mean, honestly, I just feel like it really, it's something that comes natural to us in adding color. You know, our culture is already so colorful. You see color everywhere. And so I think just embedding color into our pastries is just an extension of the culture. I've never really put a lot of thought into it.
Yeah, it's just so natural. Yeah,
it's just so natural.
Well, I love that you're talking to me from you have this like, beautiful black and green, like tropical plant background. You've got this amazing yellow and brown patterned shirt on. And your book is just absolutely saturated in color. So that, I love that.
Yeah, for me, color has always been a really big part of my life and the work that I do. I went to school up in Humboldt State, and I really wanted to get into advertising, and I learned that a little too late into my undergrad career, and so I ended up going into graphic design, and I went into PR. And so graphic design has really just guided my way through photography and the things that I enjoy and the things that I really incorporate into my work as Chicano Eats. And so I always have to have color. I love bright colors. It's the way that I get to also infuse my queer identity into my work. You know, these colors are really loud. They're very vibrant and saturated. And so it's such a huge part of my life.
Yeah. Well, and part of your identity too, at least in terms of the work you do, is, you know, you're known as someone who has developed all these recipes that are Mexican, sometimes in tradition, but oftentimes in spirit, and you use your own flavors and you know, you exhibit a lot of your own personal creativity in your cooking. And I'm curious, so when you were creating this book, how did you decide, like, which recipes you wanted to have, like, an iconic, straight-up recipe for? Maybe you would call it traditional, you call it typical, and which ones you want to put your own spin on?
That's a really hard question to answer because there's really so many things that I wanted to incorporate, and I had very limited space in the book to work with. And so thinking about pan dulce, there's over 500 different pieces of pan dulce to start with. So how am I going to work that into a book where I can probably get about 80 recipes in? And so I really had to go back and forth, but ultimately, I ended up going with the staples that you are going to run into, like I was saying earlier. If you walk into any panaderia here in the U.S., you're going to find the conchas, the roles de canela, which is like our take on cinnamon rolls, and all of these other breads. And so that's what you're going to find in the book. You're going to find those conchas, the polvorones, the rebanadas, all of those things. But they all have a tweak here and there. Because when I develop recipes, I tend to be a little analytical about what's going in there, why it's going in there. You know, there's one recipe in there. It's my Carlota de Mango con Limón. Carlota is a Mexican icebox cake that's comprised of a cream cheese and lime juice filling that's sweetened with condensed milk. And then you have layers of Maria cookies in between. And so for me, I was like, how can I make this just a little bit more special? When I think of the combination of cream cheese and lime juice, I think of something that's going to be very tangy, very tart. And so for me, the solution was to incorporate mango puree into the filling. It balances everything out, and it complements the tanginess and the tartness of the lime juice. And so making tweaks like that and incorporating little twists here and there aren't very difficult.
Yeah. Here's another recipe I saw in your book that I am fascinated by. Pan de elote. So elote means corn, but not the corn that you use for tortillas, like sweet corn, right?
Yes.
Tell us about this recipe.
Yeah. My mom's side of the family is known for cooking. They are the inspirations for everything that I do. But she's not a baker. She never has been. And pan de elote was one of the things that she knew how to make, and it was perfect every single time. That and flan. So pan de elote is our take on the cornbread. What's really interesting about this is that it's sort of, the consistency of it is between like a cornbread and like a bundt cake. So the crumb is very tender, but very tight and very spongy. Okay. And it's one of the things that I love about it so much. And it starts off with sweet white corn, which is what I prefer to use. And whenever someone wants to make this recipe, I always encourage them to use fresh corn because it's going to be a lot more milky and you're going to be able to get a lot more starches out of the kernels. That only adds to the finished product and the texture. And so what's great about this recipe is that you don't need any fancy equipment. You can make this with a blender and two big bowls. You mix all of your dry ingredients in one bowl, and then in the second, you mix together your sugar, your milk, your melted butter, and then the pureed corn. And then you incorporate the wet into the dry, and you pour this into your prepared loaf pan. And then an hour and like 10 minutes later, you have this really beautiful and very, really nicely domed loaf. And it's just, it's so delicious. It's one of my favorite things to make in the summer when corn is just at its peak. It's so good by itself. But I also suggest adding a little dab of butter and a drizzle of honey with some cafecito or some chocolate, and you're good to go.
Oh, that sounds great. Well, thank you so much, Esteban.
You're so welcome. Thank you again, Francis. It's been a great time.
Esteban Castillo is the author of Chicano Bakes, recipes for Mexican pan dulce, tamales, and my favorite desserts. You can find his recipe for the pan de elote we talked about at splendidtable.org. Coming up.
So self-saucing pudding, actually, it's, you know, the name speaks for itself. It's a pudding that self-sauces. Basically, you put the bake into the oven and a miracle happens, and then you get this sauce at the bottom of the cake.
That's Britain's great baker, Chetna McCann, and her spice-filled sweets. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Our show is supported by Hero Bread. You know, for a lot of us, bread has been a staple all our lives. Toast at breakfast, sandwiches at lunch, a nice buttered roll at dinner. It's comforting and delicious, and bread is often what we crave. But sometimes, it can sit a little heavy after a meal. That's where Hero Bread comes in. They've created fluffy, delicious versions of the breads that we're used to, but that include no net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and fewer calories. Oh, and there's more good stuff too, like protein and fiber. Hero Bread has everything from your daily sandwich loaf to tortillas or hot dog and hamburger buns. The products are flavorful and they have something for every craving, from a dressed-up breakfast burrito to a late-night PB&J. They even have monthly small-batch drops of indulgent treats like 2-gram net-carb Hero Croissant or the 1-gram net-carb Hero Cheddar Biscuit. Don't give up being a breadhead. Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code TABLE at checkout. That's TABLE at hero.co. I'm Francis Lam, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. We have been baking up a storm today with New York pastry chef Natasha Pickowitz, Mexican-American cookbook author Esteban Castillo, and now one of my favorite ever contestants on the Great British Baking Show, Chetna McCann. Ever since her season of that show, Chenna has, I don't know, like transformed herself into a cookbook producing machine. Her sixth book came out last year called Chetna's Easy Baking with a Twist of Spice. So hi, Chetna. It's so good to see you.
Hello. Hello. Good to see you too.
I first came upon you, I think as many people do, I watched you on the Great British Baking Show. And I was surprised to read in your new baking book that when you grew up in India, you were in a community where Western style baking wasn't really a thing. And your mom was actually the only person you knew who owned an oven and actually loved to bake cakes. How did she get into that?
I think she just loves trying new things, and she is still exactly the same. So she's a very curious cook, which I love about her. Yeah. And at that time, because no one else was baking at home, there was some bakeries, not many, where you could buy like certain only few cakes. So she did, I remember we were still in school. In one summer holiday, she did a baking class and learned how to make a few cakes, basic cakes. And that's when she bought this oven, which, by the way, she still has. One day, I really need to take a picture of that when I visit her. But so it's like a round, like a casserole box, just a big, that just plugs into one room to another. So sometimes she would plug it in the corridor, sometimes in our bedroom, sometimes in her bedroom. It was just amazing. So obviously, it was quite limited what could go into that oven because it was like a round, certain shape. So she would always just bake round cakes.
But then that was the cakes you knew, round cakes.
Absolutely. And we weren't complaining. and, you know, we were very, very pleased that she was baking. So, I think it's amazing that at that time, her generation, she was trying out something which was not a popular thing to do. Mm. And it's not like she could discuss with her friends, oh, this has gone wrong. It was literally trial and error.
Yeah. And did you take it up at that time or did you take up baking later?
Actually, that's when I started as well. So after she had done her class and she learned the basics, I learned from her just basic cakes. I'm not talking fancy cakes. I'm talking vanilla cake and one of her very famous cakes, the date cake, which is eggless, which is why she makes them so often because, you know, a lot of people in India don't eat eggs. And that's when I started baking a few basic cakes. And at that point, I started baking birthday cakes for us all. So, it has been something that I've loved from very young age.
Yeah. And then, you know, fast forward however many years later, and here you are baking up a storm in front of your entire country, actually the entire world, because, you know, that show is popular the world over. So there are so many amazing sounding recipes in your book. I definitely want to talk to you about a whole bunch of them. And one that really caught my eye was the masala chai tres leches cake. I love tres leches cake. You know, it's a very common, typical cake all over Latin America. I think of it mostly as Mexican, but it's popular all over Latin America. And it's soaked in cream and condensed milk and evaporated milk. It's just so smushy and delicious. But I didn't realize that it had traveled over, you know, back into Europe. Tell me how you came upon tres leches.
So this was quite interesting because I live in quite a small town here in the UK, and there is a little baking group here. Uh-huh. And they meet once a month and they like choose a subject or some theme, and then they bake according to that theme, all of them. And once I went on Bake Off, I had not heard of that group beforehand, but once I went on Bake Off, one of the ladies from the group emailed me and said, why don't you come to our group? And I said, why not? So I went there, and the theme was cakes from around the world. And I remember at that point, she actually named it three milk cake, which I will remember forever, because she didn't call it tres leches. She just said three milk cake. And I ate it, and I'm such a cake fan that I fell in love. It was moist. It was delicious. It was melt in your mouth kind of, you know, deliciousness. And I had never heard or had that cake before. And that actually stayed with me. Obviously, you know, there were no recipes. She was not giving out recipes. Everyone had just baked. And so when I was doing this book, I thought, you know, I have to do my own version. And who doesn't like masala chai? So, you know, I thought, that's it. Combine the two. And here is that recipe.
Oh, I love it. How do you make your masala chai? Like, what are the spices that you like?
So there's actually a whole lot of spices that go in, and they vary from family to family, home to home. So I like to put green cardamoms, a little bit of lots of actually fresh ginger. Mm. It could be grated with the skin on. And also you could add a few cloves in there. You could add a little bit of cinnamon stick in there. But these are the basic ones. And then people carry on and sometimes add star anise, they'll add fennel seeds, but I usually stop at the 3-4 spices.
Mm-hmm. I love black pepper and masala chai too. I love that little bit of heat that comes with it.
Yeah, no, I don't add black pepper to chai.
But yeah, having that mixture soaked into the cake must just be unreal.
Exactly. And that tea flavor as well. So what I did was I broke the two things separately. So I added the tea into the soak, into the milk mixture, and I added the spices into the cake because I wanted the whole cake to taste of the spices. So so I divided the flavors into both the cake and the syrup.
I love that. Cool. Let's go to another one. This is, I mean, even this, the title is mesmerizing. It is a chocolate and coconut spiced self-saucing pudding. So what is a self-saucing pudding?
So self-saucing pudding, actually, it's, you know, the name is, speaks for itself. It's a pudding that
you... sounds incredible.
It's a pudding that self-sauces.
Yeah.
Basically, you put the bake into the oven, and when you get the bake out, you will have a little sauce at the bottom of the pudding because the sauce has come out from the cake mixture, and that's why it is called it, because, you know, kind of a miracle happens in the oven, and then you get this sauce at the bottom of the cake.
Okay, so first of all, just to be clear to our listeners, when we say pudding here, we mean in the British sense. So it's actually baked. It's more like a cake, like a sticky toffee pudding, not a pudding in the American sense, which we usually use to, you know, talk about a custard. So this comes out of the oven. It's a cake, but then when you take a spoonful of the cake, there's a sauce on the bottom. How do you make it? What happens? I know you just referred to it as a miracle. Do you like do an incantation, or is there actually like a mixture of ingredients that makes this happen?
So, you know, I'm not going to get into the science of this because I think baking is magical, and this is what, you know, it is true though, but basically you make a lovely light sponge cake mixture. Mm-hmm. And then you put that into your tin you know, whatever dish you're using, and then you make a lovely sauce. So in this case, I have made the sauce with brown sugar, cocoa powder, a bit of water, and also I've added coconut milk because of the flavor I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
So you have this runny, liquid, delicious sauce, which you then pour over the cake mixture. So when you put the cake pudding in the oven, the syrup is on the top and the cake is at the bottom. But when it comes out, you have this fluffy looking, gorgeous chocolate cake. And when you scoop into it, you'll see a pool of chocolate sauce in the bottom.
Oh, God. That sounds incredible. And I imagine during the baking, like, obviously to switch positions, they had to kind of like soak their way through each other, right? So it infuses, both of them are infused with the flavor of the other, I imagine.
Absolutely right. So the cake in this instance, in this pudding, is really moist, and you can overbake it and then you won't get much moisture. So mm-hmm. obviously timing is key. But yeah, the pudding here is really, really moist and kind of, yeah, soaked through.
Oh, God. Sounds awesome. And,
it is so good, especially in this cold weather. It is actually, even I want to make it right now.
after you've made it, I'm sure 35 times to get to work, you're going to like go make it after this call. So the last one I want to talk to you about too is a savory recipe. You have a lot of savory recipes in the book, and this is the chana dal stuffed yogurt bread. So the chana dal is like a spiced chickpea stuffing, but tell us about the yogurt bread, because it looks like it comes together super fast. It's not a yeasted bread, but it's got yogurt and lemon and flour. Tell us about that, the yogurt bread, and how that works.
So this particular recipe was inspired by an Indian bread called bhatura. And bhatura is something we make in the North India. And it's usually served with chole, which is chickpea curry.
Okay.
And this bhatura is, like you said, it hasn't got yeast. It's a quick dough that you prepare with yogurt, which actually then gives it that lightness and that fluffiness, like a pillowy texture. And I thought, you know, that's
so cool.
A great dough. Why don't I use it for a flatbread and instead of frying, like make a paratha out of it?
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I did. And chana dal is, it's quite a meaty dal. You know, lentils, yeah. There are so many kinds of lentils. And every lentil has got their own quality, their own flavor. This one is quite heavy. It's quite meaty. And that's why I chose this. And I thought I'm going to add something more kind of rich to this, which is why I added feta to this. And it will add that saltiness and that creaminess, richness to the filling. So these are super quick to make. And once you've made them, you can have them piping hot, but you can also have them at room temperature. So they're great for carrying it for picnics or lunch boxes or whatever, or make it beforehand for your meals.
Yeah. And like not having to wait for the bread to proof is so interesting.
Yes.
It's just baking soda and the yogurt and lemon reacting to give it the puff, right?
Absolutely. And it doesn't have like a puff, like a puri or a bhatura, but mm-hmm. It has that lightness to it. So the actual dough, because it's so thin, rolled out thinly, it's got that pillowy texture to it.
Oh, cool. Do you ever make it without the stuffing, just to make the flatbread?
Yes, absolutely, which is what is called bhatura. So if you make it with the stuffing, you can roll it out and deep fry it, and then it puffs up like a ball, and it is so, so good.
Oh, that sounds awesome. Well, okay, well, I am super excited to bake out this book, and I didn't realize you have like another book coming out. Like this book came out last year, and you have another book coming out this year. I can't imagine how hardworking you are and how you just keep cranking these books out, but I look forward to catching up.
Yes, thank you so much. Yes, I've got a new book out in the summer. It's called Chetna's Indian Feasts. So it's very different to this one, but it's all about bringing together friends and family.
Terrific. Well, thank you, and I look forward to it.
Thank you so much.
Chetna McCann is the author of Chetna's Easy Baking with a Twist of Spice. And her next book, coming out in August of 2023, is Chetna's Indian Feasts. You can find her recipe for that magical chocolate coconut spiced self-saucing pudding at splendidtable.org. And that is our show for the week. Thank you for listening. Go make a cake. We'll talk to you next week. APM Studios are run by Chandra Cavani and Joanne Griffith. Beth Perlman's our executive producer, and The Splendid Table was created by Sally Swift and Lynn Rosetto Casper. It's made every week by technical producer Jennifer Lubke, producer Erica Romero, digital producer James Napoli, and managing producer Sally Swift. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you like to get your podcasts. Take some time to leave us a review. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM Studios.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Jerez, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.